Everybody's talking at me. Talking about it.
Hammer dog. TRE. Talk Radio Europe.
They try to tell us we're too young. Too young. They say that love's a word we've only heard, but can't begin to know the meaning of. And yet, we're not too young. This love will last, though years may go, and then someday they may recall we were not too young at all. Say that love's a word we've only heard, but can't begin to know the meaning of. And yet we're not too young. This love will last, though years may go, and then someday they may recall we were not too young.
Was the crooning voice of the late Jimmy Young. He spent almost three decades at BBC Radio 2 and died sadly peacefully at home on Monday afternoon of this week. We are going to have a look back at the life of a legend with pretty much another legend, Mike Hollingsworth. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Bill. How are you
doing? Very good. Before we start, let's just do this. We have to do this and play with it. Was the theme tune to the JY Prog, as he used to call it. The actual track's called Town Talk. That's irrelevant, but that was the theme tune. What, this instantly recognisable, isn't it?
Absolutely. He used to try and come up with, as soon as that came on, he used to try and come up with all sorts of alliteration. Not TTFN, because that's what he said at the end, but if he could, he would come up with something which would sort of be MYFN, you know, morning you, you know, whatever.
Now, Mike, I didn't know, I knew you were involved in radio, but obviously your career was stellar in television, in breakfast television particularly. I didn't know you were involved in the Jimmy Young programme until you emailed me last week and said that you were a news producer for him.
Yes, funnily enough, my career went from television, Anglia Television, and then into radio with local radio in the UK when it first started. And I became the... head of what was called GNS, General News Service, which supplied news to all the local radio stations.
Okay.
After I'd been at Leicester and Durham. And then, because we were sort of more... we were more flexible, I think, than the traditional BBC. So, and that rather attracted Jimmy Young, and so I was recruited for two periods of 6 months... to be attached, as they say in the BBC.
Yes. It's funny, though, isn't it? You get attached. Yes, you do. Yeah.
To the JY prog. And then I went there for a slightly longer time. I was standing in, actually, for the guy who was the traditional news producer of the show during those 6 months attachments. He was a guy called Charles Thompson, and he went off to write Bing Crosby's biography.
Really?
Much to Jimmy Young's annoyance, because he thought he was due a biography as well.
Let's go back to the start there. We played a record there, Jimmy Young, Too Young, and most people probably don't remember or didn't even know in the first place. He was a bit of a pop star and had a string of hit singles.
Certainly was.
Yeah.
And, of course, when he came to radio, he had been through a very down period of employment.
Yes.
So, of course, it was a lifesaver for him. But he was a star in the 1950s.
Yeah.
He sang Man from Laramie, and they tried to tell us we're too young,
yeah,
as he just played.
Yeah.
And he was a real star. But then he fell from grace. I think he said Elvis destroyed him or something.
Mm.
You know, Elvis probably destroyed a lot of people's singing careers.
Indeed.
And so he was in the doldrums.
I think at one point it was so bad for him that he literally was thinking of committing suicide at
point. Yes. He was quite a depressive individual, too. I can tell you about some of the mornings we had trying to get him out of bed.
Wow.
But, yeah, it's understandable. A lot of people went through that time where they were famous, and then they dropped out of sight.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the sort of reverse of being at the heights, being at
difficult
the very
one.
Low.
Very
depths,
difficult one.
You know.
But extraordinarily, he then had an even bigger career in radio. He got a very lucky break, to be fair, to have stepped into a plum job.
Yeah, he did. He was recruited to Radio 1 when it first started, And when you think about Radio 1 and Jimmy
Incredible.
Young, you don't think they're very compatible.
No.
But he was one of the crew on the first... It was called Radio 247, I think.
That's right, and they're all in the picture, aren't they? And he is in the picture. And I think at that point, there was a kind of a budgetary issue, and Radio 1 and Radio 2... sometimes transmitted the same program.
They did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They joined forces,
right,
especially during the evening times.
Mm.
But Jim was recruited. He then became a self-operating, just like you, disc jockey, and he mastered it very quickly, and he was always very conscious. The moment his career started to go back up again, he was always very conscious of who JY was, and we were always reminded in the office, this would not be a JY thing to do, that would not be a JY.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
How interesting.
Yes. Because he sort of protected the new image that he had, because he was so frightened of losing it and dropping into those doldrums again.
And it was an odd listen, because you had Tony Blackburn and all his and all that stuff, and then JY was kind of laid back and calm and methodical.
Yes.
Couldn't have been more different.
Yes. He did have one of those voices, though, a bit like Chris Evans and Chris Tarrant, and it was one of those voices that would wake you up in the morning if you needed it, and it was very up, so it was a chirpy voice, even though it was, as you say, laid back.
Well, let's have a listen to it, because this is legendary, because here we have Wogan handing over to Jimmy Young. And, of course, their kind of handovers became epic, didn't they?
They did.
I mean, this one here, I'm not going to play all of it, it's 13 minutes long.
Jim used to live in fear of them.
Really? Well, this is a typical Wogan-Jimmy Young exchange.
Love is in the air, so watch out, Jimbo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because you could catch it.
Yeah, I know. Listen, I switched on this morning in time to hear you being rather derogatory about me and my chest, I rather fancy, and being taken to task by my lot.
Well, your lot wrote and said, leave him alone, they said.
Quite.
Have a bit of respect for the aged and infirm.
They can be quite savage when aroused.
Oh, yeah, when they've got the teeth in.
Yes. I heard that you followed that with a spirited defense of the Eurovision Song Contest, followed by, did I detect, the hint of a grovel, the tiny touch of a forelock, perhaps, in the direction of one of our, not yet, one of our television chiefs. Grovel? Yes, you may well laugh.
Why do you think my tongue is so brown?
I don't have to grovel. They don't give me any worry anyway.
We should wear black shoes for a change. Yeah, what?
You were exposing the ages of the shadows and everything. Yes.
What's that?
Visiting. Oh, no, that's a good thing.
Is that a message?
Yeah.
Visiting doctor. You stick that in the front of your car,
yes.
Do you?
It doesn't mean I am a visiting doctor. It means I am visiting the doctor.
Just wonderful. And to hear those two together, of course, very sad to hear them together now, but that was magic radio, wasn't it?
Yeah, to think they both left us in the last year, actually. Yes, you're right. But, you know, Jim used to live in fear of those handovers, and it's because Wogan was much sharper in his intellect than Jim, and Jim sort of, when he was at the microphone, was slightly detached as well, and sometimes Wogan would catch him out. In fact, it got so bad. We used to listen to the show in the office. We used to deliberately listen to the show to make sure we could write something, because we used to write a lot of his stuff, in order that he could hit back at Wogan. But Wogan very rarely got caught out.
I can imagine.
And in the end, you know, the BBC took notice of the hostility that was growing between them and put Ken Bruce in between them for a couple of hours.
Love it. Now, news and current affairs were quite a big part of his show. It wasn't a kind of, it certainly wasn't a Tony Blackburn kind of show. And one of the main things about it was that he interviewed people, and he interviewed politicians, and not just any politicians. They basically queued up.
Yes, it didn't happen straight away. But what it was that the show became a sort of consumer orientated show. We used to have people in like Tony DeAngeli, who was the editor of The Grocer, and we used to actually cause shortages in the UK, and it used to be very naughty. This, it used to be deliberately done sometimes, you know. Right. Oh, there's going to be a shortage of coffee because the coffee beans in Brazil have all gone, and Tesco's used to go mad because people would run into the shops and clear the shelves. But it was basically a consumer orientated show.
Yes, and they had a legal beagle, didn't they, as well?
That's right, beagle from the Consumers Association.
Yeah,
and in the end, what happened was that Dominic Harrod, who was the BBC's economics correspondent, one day he suggested to us that he could bring in Dennis Healy after he'd done his budget. And because Dennis Healy wanted to meet Jim, believe it or not, because Edna, Dennis Healy's wife, was a great fan of
the
show.
Wonderful.
So what happened was Dennis Healy came in and there was chats going on, and eventually it became a thing where politicians of different sorts used to fall over each other to try and get on the show.
Amazing.
Not the big ones, perhaps, to begin with, but you know, Dennis Healy was probably the biggest name of the time.
And what about Jimmy's brain at that point? I mean, you as the news producer, were you writing his questions for him, or did he know all that stuff?
What, you mean we used to take his brain out every morning and wash it? Well, we used to write a lot of the questions, and sometimes that would be very irritating to the producers, because I remember, you know, you would write a list of 10 questions, And sometimes he would ask a question that had just been answered, as it were, rather having not taken any notice. But as you know, when you're self-operating in a studio, you're setting up the next...
Yeah.
Well, in those days, you were setting up the next disc.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of mechanical work to be done.
Yes.
So sometimes he would set somebody off talking, and then he would...
Get on with something.
...mentally detach himself and do something else.
Yeah.
And so he hadn't quite heard everything that the person had said, and then he'd end up asking the same... A question to
Bless
which,
him.
As I say, the answer had just been given. But the real coup, of course, was in 1975 when Margaret Thatcher became leader of the Conservative Party, and we actually managed to get Margaret Thatcher on the show.
Brilliant.
But that was actually by a fluke. One of my deputies at the time was a guy called Nigel Havers.
Mm-hmm.
Nigel was a budding actor.
Good grief.
And he kept going missing because as I found out, he'd gone to auditions.
Yeah.
And what had happened was that Nigel's job was to bring down the scripts to the studio when I'd gone down with Jim to start the show. And he'd also meet the guests in reception and bring them into the show. And Nigel kept going missing. and eventually this got too much. So I fired him.
Oh, funny.
And after I'd fired him, about 2 hours later, I got a telephone call. And it was from Sir Michael Havers, who was the Shadow Attorney General and was also Nigel's dad.
Oh, my goodness.
And he said, Mr. Hollingsworth, he said, I'm really taken aback by the fact that Nigel has lost his job. I know he has this funny thing about wanting to be an actor, but, you know, he's never going to do it. But his mother keeps encouraging him because she was on the stage. I'd be very grateful if you'd give him his job back. And I said... Sir Michael, no, I can't possibly do that. And he said, well, I've got a bargain to offer you. He said, Ted Heath is standing for re-election as leader of the Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. And when he gets back in, as he obviously will, perhaps you'd like to interview him. I know you like politicians on your show. So I said, well, that sounds a very interesting proposition. So he said, could Nigel have his job back?
Brilliant.
And I said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll keep Nigel at home. He can go to as many auditions as he wants. We'll send him 2 sacks a week of correspondence.
Right.
And he can sort it out for me.
Oh,
and, you know, so that gives him the time to schedule himself. And so, of course, the election took place, and Ted Heath got defeated by Margaret Thatcher. So on the day that it was announced... About an hour after it was announced, I rang Sir Michael Havers and I said, now, your promise, of course, so Margaret Thatcher will be coming in. And he said, oh, no, I can't possibly help you there. He said, Ted Heath, I'm part of Ted Heath's group. I can't possibly help you with Margaret Thatcher. And I said, oh, dear, what a shame. I said, so no Margaret Thatcher, no job for Nigel. And he said, Mr. Hollingsworth, this is blackmail. And I said, well, you're the Shadow Attorney General. You should know. And he slammed the phone down. But about half an hour later, he rang back and he said, Mr. Hollingsworth, you should come down to the central lobby in the House of Commons at 5 o'clock and you should meet Nigel there and you'll go to see Mrs. Thatcher. And it's up to you to persuade her that your show is the right show to come on.
Amazing.
And sure enough, Nigel and I turned up in Mrs. Thatcher's office. She shoved a back of an envelope towards us and she said, oh, I've just decided on my Shadow Cabinet. What do you think? Well, of course, you know, there were names like Sir Keith Joseph on there. And of course, Nigel and I said, oh, wonderful cabinet. Anyway, so then she said, now, what about this J.Y. prog? And we talked about the show, and she had an American advisor there at the time
who
was pretty keen that she should address a housewife audience.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, she said, okay, well, Mr. Young can interview me then. And I said, oh, no, you have to come into the studio. And she said, well, when would you like? Where's my diary? And I said, no, it must be tomorrow. And sure enough... She came in,
really?
And there you were. She walked in, and then, of course, even the Guardian said, well, this is the new political platform of the age.
Yes.
Great fun.
Brilliant story, Mike. It's all Nigel Havers' fault.
It's all Nigel Havers' fault, not mine. But after that, of course, Andy called her Margaret instead of, you know, calling her what he should have done. And
it's Nigel Havers on the phone for you now.
Yeah, Nigel's ringing me up. I'm really sorry about that. Thought I'd turned it off.
Amazing. And, of course, Margaret Thatcher then became an enormous fan of the show and went back a lot.
Yes, 14 times.
14 times?
Yeah, I had to escape. I had, I escaped about a year later.
Amazing.
Because of the success that we had, I was very lucky that I was promoted to become deputy editor of the Today programme on Radio 4.
Right.
They thought I should take on more serious tasks.
Oh,
but Jim carried on, and he did amazing interviews after that.
Good for him. The show was so unique. One of the main parts of the show, which nobody who ever listened to the JY Prog would ever forget, will be this.
What's the recipe today, Jim?
And that is Raimondo. What's the recipe today, Jim? Which is just a voice sped up by double, it sounds like to me. No more difficult than that.
That's what it was.
Yeah, and he used to do recipes on the air, and they were wonderful. And that actually inspired me at one point when I was working at Radio Victory in Portsmouth. We had a little kitchen, and we put a microphone in it, and we did recipes and actually cooked during the show.
Really?
We did cooking on the radio, which maybe in retrospect wasn't the best idea in the world. But
well,
you
as
go.
You say, I mean, you know, cooking on the radio is probably the last thing.
Yeah,
that was
a must listen, wasn't it? The recipe on the JY Prog, must listen.
Yeah.
And this ludicrous creature, Raimondo.
But they would, absolutely. But they would have to be, those recipes had to be vetted, of course. Being the BBC, they had to be made sure that all the recipes were nutritious and goodness knows what else.
Fantastic. So, in terms of working with Jimmy Young, I get the impression he probably wasn't as easy as, say, Terry Wogan.
Certainly not. No. Jim was very aware, as I said earlier, of his own persona, having been in the doldrums before, and he was determined that the JY image would be kept absolutely as he wanted it to be. I probably shouldn't be telling tales totally out of school. You know, he used to... He didn't have a lot of hair, Jim. he used to... get up in the morning and, of course, slap on a what Wogan would call a rug.
Yeah.
Did
he have far to come from the home to the studio?
Yeah, he lived in West London, actually.
Okay.
He lived past Hammersmith.
Right.
And we used to have to ring him up in the morning at 7 o'clock to make sure he was awake.
Yeah. Did he have a car sent for him?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
But... he didn't always wake up in time. And then we used to have to ring the caretaker of the block because maybe he'd been out the night before taken a sleeping tablet or whatever.
Oh, my goodness.
And, there were a few times when Jim had to be... the caretaker had a spare key to his flat.
Oh, funny.
Used to have to go in there and... get him out, chivvy him out of bed.
Remember, you've got a radio show. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, never done that myself. Never in a million years. In the end, of course... they decided to get rid of him much, much later on because the bosses had changed and Jim Moyer, the new controller, already got rid of Ed Stewart. He already got rid of John Dunn and he kind of turned his attention to Jimmy.
Yeah, but Jimmy
Young.
Was a political decision. Although the age thing was pushed as being the real reason, the actual reason was that it was political. There was a general thought that he was becoming extremely right-wing. And some of those interviews were getting very sort of right-wing, and the friendship with Margaret Thatcher didn't help. At that time, a new director-general, Greg Dyke, had come in, a man who'd given £50,000 to the Labour Party, so you can tell which way his leanings were. And, it was really a political decision, and Jeremy Vine was brought in to take over.
Yes.
I actually asked if I could come and produce the last... few weeks of Jim's show. He wasn't very well anyway.
He didn't go easily, did he? He didn't just go, thanks very much, I'm off then.
No. And I wasn't allowed to produce his last shows either because it was generally thought, you know, the sooner he goes, the better.
I think, wasn't there
a campaign?
There was a motion in Parliament
there was
at
a
one
motion
point
in
to
Parliament.
Keep him on?
Yes. All sorts of tricks were tried to keep Jim on.
And he ended up
as a columnist in The Express. Until, 2 years ago, he was writing a column in the Express.
Amazing.
Which, a fairly one newspaper that receives right-wing views fairly well.
Yes. Well, he certainly is a legend, isn't he? That's one of the, it's an overused word, but Jimmy Young's certainly a legend.
He was a lovely guy, yeah. And no matter, you know, what he protected his own image, yes, yeah. But actually, there was always a smile and a genuine, you know, and that was the secret of his success at interviews, of course. He was just an ordinary chap, exactly. Asking ordinary chaps questions.
Exactly.
He wasn't doing the Paxman thing, yeah. He wasn't doing the Humphreys thing. He was just asking the question that
down
the person
the
in the street.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that is why I think a lot of people fell for him and yeah. for his radio show.
Brilliant. Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you back in. Thank you so much
Lovely
for coming in.
Lovely to see you again, Bill.
All right, all the best. Mike Hollingsworth.
Talk Radio Europe.